The difficulty seems to arise from not attending to the dramatic character of the writings of Plato. There are two, or more, sides to questions, and these are parted among the different speakers. Sometimes one view or aspect of a question is made to predominate over the rest, as in the Gorgias or Sophist, but in other dialogues truth is divided, as in the Laches and Protagoras, and the interest of the piece consists in the contrast of opinions. The confusion caused by the irony of Socrates, who, if he is true to his character, cannot say anything of his own knowledge, is increased by the circumstance that in the Theaetetus and some other dialogues he is occasionally playing both parts himself, and even charging his own arguments with unfairness. In the Theaetetus he is designedly held back from arriving at a conclusion. For we cannot suppose that Plato conceived a definition of knowledge to be impossible. But this is his manner of approaching and surrounding a question. The lights which he throws on his subject are indirect, but they are not the less real for that. He has no intention of proving a thesis by a cut-and-dried argument, nor does he imagine that a great philosophical problem can be tied up within the limits of a definition. If he has analyzed a proposition or notion, even with the severity of an impossible logic, if half-truths have been compared by him with other half-truths, if he has cleared up or advanced popular ideas, or illustrated a new method, his aim has been sufficiently accomplished. The writings of Plato belong to an age in which the power of analysis had outrun the means of knowledge, and through a spurious use of dialectic, the distinctions which had been already won from the void and formless infinite seem to be rapidly returning to their original chaos. The two great speculative philosophies, which a century earlier had so deeply impressed the mind of Hellas, were now degenerating into heuristic. The contemporaries of Plato and Socrates were vainly trying to find new combinations of them, or to transfer them from the object to the subject. The Megarians, in their first attempts to attain a severe logic, were making knowledge impossible. They were asserting the one good under many names, and, like the Cynics, seemed to have denied predication, while the Cynics themselves were depriving virtue of all which made virtue desirable in the eyes of Socrates and Plato. And besides these, we find mention in the later writings of Plato, especially in the Theaetetus, Sophist, and Laws, of certain impenetrable godless persons, who will not believe what they cannot hold in their hands, and cannot be approached in argument, because they cannot argue. No school of Greek philosophers exactly answers to these persons, in whom Plato may perhaps have blended some features of the atomists with the vulgar materialistic tendencies of mankind in general. And not only was there a conflict of opinions, but the stage which the mind had reached presented other difficulties hardly intelligible to us, who live in a different cycle of human thought. All times of mental progress are times of confusion. We only see, or rather seem to see things clearly, when they have been long fixed and defined. In the age of Plato, the limits of the world of imagination, and of pure abstraction, of the old world and the new, were not yet fixed. The Greeks, in the 4th century before Christ, had no words for subject and object, and no distinct conception of them. Yet they were always hovering about the question involved in them. The analysis of sense, and the analysis of thought, were equally difficult to them, and hopelessly confused by the attempt to solve them, not through an appeal to facts, but by the help of general theories respecting the nature of the universe. Plato, in his Theaetetus, gathers up the skeptical tendencies of his age, and compares them. But he does not seek to reconstruct out of them a theory of knowledge. The time at which such a theory could be framed had not yet arrived, for there was no measure of experience with which the ideas warming in men's minds could be compared. The meaning of the word science could scarcely be explained to them, except from the mathematical sciences, which alone offered the type of universality and certainty. Philosophy was becoming more and more vacant and abstract. And not only the Platonic ideas and the elitic being, but all abstractions seem to be at variance with sense, and at war with one another. the want of the Greek mind in the 4th century before Christ was not another theory of rest or motion, or being or atoms, but rather a philosophy which could free the mind from the power of abstractions and alternatives, and show how far rest, and how far motion, how far the universal principle of being, and the multitudinous principle of atoms, entered into the composition of the world, which could distinguish between the true and false analogy, and allow the negative as well as the positive a place in human thought. To such a philosophy Plato, in the Theaetetus, offers many contributions. He has followed philosophy into the region of mythology, and pointed out the similarities of opposing phases of thought. He has also shown that extreme abstractions are self-destructive, and, indeed, hardly distinguishable from one another. But his intention is not to unravel the whole subject of knowledge, if this had been possible, and several times in the course of the dialogue he rejects explanations of knowledge which have germs of truth in them, as, for example, the resolution of the compound into the simple, or right opinion with a mark of difference. Turchin, who has come to Megara from the country, is described as having looked in vain for Euclides in the Agora. The latter explains that he has been down to the harbour, and on his way thither had met Theaetetus, who was being carried up from the army to Athens. He was scarcely alive, for he had been badly wounded at the Battle of Corinth, and had taken the dysentery which prevailed in the camp. The mention of his condition suggests the reflection, what a loss he will be. Yes, indeed, replies Euclid. Only just now I was hearing of his noble conduct in the battle. That I should expect, but why did he not remain at Megara? I wanted him to remain, but he would not, so I went with him as far as Rhenium. And as I parted from him, I remembered that Socrates had seen him, when he was a youth, and had remarkable conversation with him, not long before his own death. And he then prophesied of him, that he would be a great man if he lived. How true that has been! How like all that Socrates said! And could you repeat the conversation? Not from memory, but I took notes when I returned home, which I afterwards filled up at leisure, and got Socrates to correct them from time to time, when I came to Athens. Turchin had long intended to ask for a sight of this writing, of which he had already heard. They are both tired, and agree to rest, and have the conversation read to them by a servant. Here is the roll, Turchin. I need only observe, that I have omitted, for the sake of convenience, the interlocutory words, said I, said he, and that Theaetetus, and Theodorus, the geometrician of Cyrene, are the persons with whom Socrates is conversing. Socrates begins by asking Theodorus whether, in his visit to Athens, he has found any Athenian youth likely to attain distinction in science. Yes, Socrates. There is one very remarkable youth, with whom I have become acquainted. He is no beauty, and therefore you need not imagine that I am in love with him, and, to say the truth, he is very like you, for he has a snub nose, and projecting eyes, although these features are not so marked in him as in you. He combines the most various qualities, quickness, patience, courage, and he is gentle as well as wise. Always silently flowing on, like a river of oil. Look, he is the middle one of those who are entering the palestra. Socrates, who does not know his name, recognizes him as the son of Euphronius, who was himself a good man and a rich. He is informed by Theodorus that the youth is named Theaetetus, but the property of his father has disappeared in the hands of trustees. This does not, however, prevent him from adding liberality to his other virtues. At the desire of Socrates he invites Theaetetus to sit by them. Yes, says Socrates, that I may see in you, Theaetetus, the image of my ugly self, as Theodorus declares. Not that his remark is of any importance, for though he is a philosopher, he is not a painter, and therefore he is no judge of our faces. But, as he is a man of science, he may be a judge of our intellects. And if he were to praise the mental endowments of either of us, in that case the hearer of the eulogy ought to examine into what he says, and the subject should not refuse to be examined. Theaetetus consents, and is caught in a trap. Then, Theaetetus, you will have to be examined, for Theodorus has been praising you in a style of which I never heard the like. He was only jesting. Nay, that is not his way, and I cannot allow you, on that pretense, to retract the assent which you have already given, or I shall make Theodorus repeat your praises, and swear to them. Theaetetus, in reply, professes that he is willing to be examined, and Socrates begins by asking him what he learns of Theodorus. He is himself anxious to learn anything of anybody, and now he has a little question to which he wants Theaetetus or Theodorus, or whichever of the company, would not be donkey to the rest, to find an answer. Without further preface, but at the same time apologizing for his eagerness, he asks, what is knowledge? Theodorus is too old to answer questions, and begs him to interrogate Theaetetus, who has the advantage of youth. Theaetetus replies, that knowledge is what he learns of Theodorus, i.e. geometry and arithmetic, and that there are other kinds of knowledge, shoemaking, carpentering, and the like. But Socrates rejoins that this answer contains too much, and also too little. For although Theaetetus has enumerated several kinds of knowledge, he has not explained the common nature of them, as if he had been asked, what is clay? And instead of saying, clay is moistened earth, he had answered, there is one clay of image makers, another of potters, another of oven makers. Theaetetus at once divines that Socrates means him to extend to all kinds of knowledge the same process of generalization which he has already learned to apply to arithmetic. For he has discovered a division of numbers into square numbers, 4, 9, 16, and c, which are composed of equal factors, and represent one figures which have equal sides, and oblong numbers, 3, 5, 6, 7. And c, which are composed of unequal factors, and represent figures which have unequal sides. But he has never succeeded in attaining a similar conception of knowledge, though he has often tried. And, when this and similar questions were brought to him from Socrates, has been sorely distressed by them. Socrates explains to him that he is in labor. For men as well as women have pangs of labor, and both at times require the assistance of midwives. And he, Socrates, is a midwife, although this is a secret. He has inherited the art from his mother Bold and Pluff, and he ushers into light, not children, but the thoughts of men. Like the midwives, who are past bearing children, he too can have no offspring. The god will not allow him to bring anything into the world of his own. He also reminds Theaetetus that the midwives are or ought to be the only matchmakers. This is the preparation for a biting jest, for those who reap the fruit are most likely to know on what soil the plants will grow. But respectable midwives avoid this department of practice, they do not want to be called procuresses. There are some other differences between the two sorts of pregnancy. For women do not bring into the world at one time real children, and at another time idols which are with difficulty distinguished from them. At first, says Socrates in his character of the man midwife, my patients are barren and stolid, but after a while they round apace, if the gods are propitious to them, and this is due, not to me but to themselves, and the god only assist, in bringing their ideas to the birth. Many of them have left me too soon, and the result has been that they have produced abortions. Or when I have delivered them of children they have lost them by an ill bringing up, and have ended by seeing themselves, as others see them, to be great fools. Aristides, the son of Lysimachus, is one of these, and there have been others. The truants often return to me, and beg to be taken back, and then, if my familiar allows me, which is not always the case, I receive them, and they begin to grow again. There come to me also those who have nothing in them, and have no need of my art, and I'm their matchmaker, see above, and marry them to Prodicus or some other inspired sage who is likely to suit them. I tell you this long story, because I suspect that you are in labor. Come then to me, who am a midwife, and the son of a midwife, and I will deliver you. And do not bite me, as the women do, if I abstract your firstborn. for I am acting out of goodwill towards you. The God who is within me is the friend of man, though he will not allow me to dissemble the truth. Once more then, Theaetetus, I repeat my old question, what is knowledge? Take courage, and by the help of God you will discover an answer. My answer is, that knowledge is perception. That is the theory of Protagoras, who has another way of expressing the same thing when he says, man is the measure of all things. He was a very wise man, and we should try to understand him. In order to illustrate his meaning, let me suppose that there is the same wind blowing in our faces, and one of us may be hot, and the other cold. How is this? Protagoras will reply, that the wind is hot to him who is cold, cold to him who is hot. And his means appears, and when you say appears to him, that means he feels. This feeling, appearance, perception, coincide with being. Suspect, however, that this was only a fake and a parlor, by which he imposed on the common herd like you and me. He told the truth in allusion to the title of his book, which was called The Truth I in Secret to His Disciples. For he was really a votary of that famous philosophy in which all things are said to be relative, nothing is great or small, or heavy or light, or one, but all is in motion and mixture and transition and flux and generation, not being, as we ignorantly affirm, but becoming. This has been the doctrine, not of Protagoras only, but of all philosophers, with the single exception of Parmenides, Empedocles, Heraclitus, and others, and all the poets, with Epicharmus, the king of comedy, and Homer, the king of tragedy, at their head, have said the same. The latter has these words, ocean, whence the gods sprang, and mother to these. And many arguments are used to show that motion is the source of life, and rest of death. Fire and warmth are produced by friction, and living creatures owe their origin to a similar cause. The bodily frame is preserved by exercise and destroyed by indolence, and if the sun ceased to move, chaos would come again. Now apply this doctrine of all is motion to the senses, and first of all to the sense of sight. The color of white, or any other color, is neither in the eyes nor out of them, but ever in motion I between the object and the eye, and varying in the case of every percipient. All is relative, and, as the followers of Protagoras remark, endless contradictions arise when we deny this, e.g. here are six dice, they are more than four and less than 12, more and also less, would you not say? Yes. But Protagoras will retort, can anything be more or less without addition or subtraction? I should say no, if I were not afraid of contradicting my former answer. And if you say yes, the tongue will escape conviction, but not the mind, as Euripides would say. True. The thoroughbred sophists, who know all that can be known, would have a sparring match over this, but you and I, who have no professional pride, want only to discover whether our ideas are clear and consistent. And we cannot be wrong in saying, first, that nothing can be greater or less while remaining equal, secondly, that there can be no becoming greater or less without addition or subtraction, thirdly, that what is and was not cannot be without having become. But then how is this reconcilable with the case of the dice and with similar examples? That is the question. I am often perplexed and amazed, Socrates, by these difficulties. That is because you are a philosopher, for philosophy begins in wonder, and Iris is the child of Thormas. Do you know the original principle on which the doctrine of Protagoras is based? No. Then I will tell you, but we must not let the uninitiated hear, and by the uninitiated mean the obstinate people who believe in nothing which they cannot hold in their hands. The brethren whose mysteries I am about to unfold to you are far more ingenious. They maintain that all is motion, and that motion has two forms, action and passion, out of which endless phenomena are created, also in two forms, sense and the object of sense, which come to the birth together. There are two kinds of motions, a slow and a fast. The motions of the agent and the patient are slower, because they move and create in and about themselves, but the things which are born of them have a swift motion, and pass rapidly from place to place. the eye and the appropriate object come together and give birth to whiteness and the sensation of whiteness. The eye is filled with seeing and becomes not sight, but a seeing eye, and the object is filled with whiteness and becomes not whiteness but white, and no other compound of either with another would have produced the same effect. All sensation is to be resolved into a similar combination of an agent and patient. Of either, taken separately, no idea can be formed, and the agent may become a patient, and the patient an agent. Hence there arises a general reflection that nothing is, but all things become, no name can detain or fix them. Are not these speculations charming, Theaetetus, and very good for a person in your interesting situation? I am offering you specimens of other men's wisdom, because I have no wisdom of my own, and I want to deliver you of something, and presently we will see whether you have brought forth wind or not. Tell me, then, what do you think of the notion that all things are becoming? When I hear your arguments, I am marvelously ready to assent. But I ought not to conceal from you that there is a serious objection which may be urged against this doctrine of Protagoras. For there are states, such as madness and dreaming, in which perception is false, and half our life is spent in dreaming, and who can say that at this instant we are not dreaming? Even the fancies of madmen are ill at the time. But if knowledge is perception, how can we distinguish between the true and the false in such cases? Having stated the objection, I will now state the answer. Protagoras would deny the continuity of phenomena. He would say that what is different is entirely different, and whether active or passive has a different power. There are infinite agents and patients in the world, and these produce in every combination of them a different perception. Take myself as an instance. Socrates may be ill, or he may be well, and remember that Socrates, with all his accidents, is spoken of. The wine which I drink when I am well is pleasant to me, but the same wine is unpleasant to me when I am ill. And there is nothing else from which I can receive the same impression, nor can another receive the same impression from the wine. Neither can I and the object of sense become separately what we become together. For the one in becoming is relative to the other, but they have no other relation, and the combination of them is absolute at each moment. In modern language, the act of sensation is really indivisible, though capable of a mental analysis into subject and object. My sensation alone is true, and true to me only. And therefore, as Protagoras says, to myself I am the judge of what is, and what is not. Thus the flux of Homer and Heraclitus, the great Protagorean saying, that man is the measure of all things, the doctrine of Theaetetus, that knowledge is perception, have all the same meaning. And this is thy new-born child, which by my art I have brought to light, and you must not be angry, if instead of rearing your infant we expose him. Theaetetus will not be angry, says Theodorus. He is very good-natured. But I should like to know, Socrates, whether you mean to say that all this is untrue. First reminding you, that I am not the bag which contains the arguments, but that I extract them from Theaetetus, shall I tell you what amazes me in your friend Protagoras? What may that be? I like his doctrine, that what appears is, but I wonder that he did not begin his great work on truth with a declaration that a pig, or a dog-faced baboon, or any other monster which has sensation, is a measure of all things. Then, while we were reverencing him as a god, he might have produced magnificent effect by expounding to us that he was no wiser than a tadpole. For if sensations are always true, and one man's discernment is as good as another's, and every man is his own judge, and everything that he judges is right and true, then what need of Protagoras to be our instructor at a high figure, and why should we be less knowing than he is, or have to go to him, if every man is the measure of all things? My own art of midwifery, and all dialectic, is an enormous folly, if Protagoras' truth be indeed truth, and the philosopher is not merely amusing himself by giving oracles out of his book.